Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be carrying on from a podcast I did last week about Roosevelt and Chamberlain, to looking at the early years of Roosevelt and Churchill's relationship. As we know, Germany invaded Poland on the 1st of September 1939, and 2 days later, Great Britain and France declare war on Germany, and the Second World War in Europe begins. Some might argue, with some degree of validity, that World War had really been ongoing in Asia since at least 1937, with the Japanese invasion of China. But for our purposes, we're sticking to a fairly standard chronology here. So, from September 1939 through to April 1940. As far as Western Europe is concerned, very little happens. The Soviet Union, just over 2 weeks later, sees the eastern half of Poland, and the Nazis knew full well this was going to happen because of the Nazi-Soviet pact that was signed in August 1939. So you have this period where William Borah, the US senator, referred to as the phony war, this kind of lull, really, until April 1940. And during that period of time, Winston Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, a role that he had occupied during the First World War, is in communication with Roosevelt. Churchill would have been a fairly marginal figure to Roosevelt. They'd only met once. Roosevelt was aware of him as an individual and his Anglo-American heritage and his public standing in Great Britain and across the British Empire. But they had only met once in London in 1918. And in 1933, Churchill had, for some reason, sent a copy of the biography of John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough, who had successfully fought at the Battle of Blenheim, to Roosevelt, with the inscription, "Best wishes for the success of the Great Crusade of modern times." And the only contact that they had with one another after that was in September 1939, September the 11th, odd prophetic date, when Churchill rejoins the war cabinet and Roosevelt sends a letter of congratulations. Roosevelt having been Assistant Navy Secretary during the First World War, and he sent a note saying, "It's because you and I occupied similar positions in World War One that I want you to know how glad I am that you are back at the Admiralty. What I want you and the Prime Minister to know is that I shall at all times welcome it if you will keep me in touch personally with anything you want me to know about." An interesting and non too cryptic message, establishing a channel between Churchill and Roosevelt. In December that year, December 1939, Churchill showed that he was clear on taking Roosevelt up on his offer by sending a telegraph saying, "Generally speaking, I think the war will begin soon now." Which is a fascinating admission for Churchill to make, that he didn't really consider that a war had started at all. I suppose if you're Polish or living in one of the Jewish ghettos, you might reconsider that. But what Churchill was talking about was a belief that a war would begin in the West in earnest in 1940. Some members of the US Congress and the US Senate looked at Europe and they saw weak-willed democracies and blustering fascist powers in the guise of Germany and Italy in some prolonged standoff with one another. And the idea that this would be a prelude to global conflict at that time seemed to be rather remote. It seemed as if Europe was stuck in some rather tragic and rather absurd deadlock, the likes which Europe was later stuck in during the Cold War. But the difference between the Cold War and this period of a phony war is the existence of nuclear weapons, which really solidified, mutually assured destruction really kind of solidified boundaries and made the idea of a rapid war of movement unthinkable. Hitler doesn't have these constraints in 1939, and the rapid war of movement is soon to come. Roosevelt, for his part, looked upon this sort of eerie silence from Europe and thought that it was possible that a negotiated settlement could emerge from it, much as negotiations over Czechoslovakia had been possible, though this time he saw himself as the role of the honest broker. At this point, even though America itself was very lightly armed, the Americans had little hope that the British or the French would be able to stand up to the Germans, particularly against German air power. In fact, the French army was significantly larger than the German army at the time, and had it not been for the catastrophic decision to distribute tanks evenly throughout army regiments and companies, and on the French army to rely on the Maginot Line, and not to build panzer armies with forces of hundreds upon hundreds of tanks which the Germans used, the story of 1940 might have been considerably different. It was very little to do with weakness in terms of manpower and in terms of armament. Renault tanks were extremely effective against German tanks at close range. It was the fact that not only were the tanks distributed so evenly across the army that they could not create a sort of a column of firepower that the Germans used in Blitzkrieg tactics to smash through enemy defences. But also, as Tony Judd in his book of essays Reappraisals points out, that some of the French generals, Hunzinger for example, were only too happy when they were defeated, the reality being that they had conspired long and wholeheartedly against the Republic and against the Popular Front when it was in power in 1936. And there was a belief amongst the generals, who many of whom went on to serve faithfully under the Vichy regime, that a more authoritarian, nationalist, anti-socialist regime and anti-Semitism was a key part of this heady mix would be ideal. So the American calculations about French power and about British power particularly weren't necessarily quite accurate, but the ultimate result is, as we know from the summer of 1940, an immense military catastrophe, to use the words of Churchill. Much of Roosevelt's information came from his ambassador to London, Joseph Kennedy. Kennedy was certain that Chamberlain would cut a deal with Hitler. He was certain that this deal might not be the worst thing in the world anyway, and that it was really the best thing that a weakened Great Britain could hope for. There was nothing about the political circumstances of late 1939 that would have prepared somebody like Kennedy for the advent of Churchill, where an entire reversal of fortunes eventually emerges, and Churchill, in spite of a knowledge that there were immense problems and weaknesses within Britain's defences, decides to make a commitment to absolute and outright victory and utter defiance of the enemy, no matter what. Joseph Kennedy wrote, "Make no mistake, there is a very definite undercurrent in this country for peace. Although everybody hates Hitler, the British still don't want to be finished economically, financially, politically and socially, which they're beginning to suspect will be their fate if the war goes on very long." And this statement itself is intriguing. Now, if Kennedy had been able to accurately gauge the mood of the nation, as sometimes some foreign diplomats sometimes are able to do so, then the British were extremely prescient in their understanding of the potential outcome of the war. Any victory would no doubt be a hollow one, and one only, I suppose, had to have lived through the previous World War and the intervening two decades to be able to come to this conclusion. In February 1940, the Assistant Undersecretary of State, Sumner Wells, was sent on a European tour of Axis and Allied powers. Wells was to really find out whether there was going to be the possibility of an American-mediated peace settlement with Hitler. So he went to Rome, Berlin, Paris and London. And Wells quickly discovered that this was not going to be possible. When he went to Italy, he found that there were Italian generals who knew that the country was woefully underprepared for war and who wanted to avoid war at any costs, but Mussolini was not listening. He went to Berlin and was harangued for several hours by Joachim von Ribbentrop. Wells's observations on the day was that the pomposity and absurdity of Ribbentrop's manner gave him the clue, and I quote, that the man is saturated with hate for England. He added that when he met Hitler, that he was thinking to himself as he got into the car that it was only too tragically plain that all decisions had already been made. The best that could be hoped for was a delay, for what little that might be worth. When Wells went to Paris, a city he knew well, he discovered that the French had, in essence, given up. The French public opinion certainly had. There had been a collapse in morale. There was very little belief in any kind of hope or the will to fight, which I think we shouldn't draw too much from that and assume that the French were ready to surrender as soon as the first German tank rumbled over the border. Certainly not. The French fight with absolute tenacity, so much so that those French soldiers, many of those French soldiers that are evacuated at Dunkirk, re-embark 48 hours later and get back on the ships back to France to continue the fighting. Wells had to disagree with Kennedy's interpretation of the British when Wells arrives in London. Wells decided that the British would fight to the very end. And he said, there appeared to be a determination that rather than live once more through the experiences that they had suffered since the autumn of 1938, they would see it through to the end, no matter how far off that end might be. nor how bitter the...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Progress towards it might prove. So again, Wells is saying something interesting there. He's saying that the embarrassed, the humiliation of appeasement, of being essentially hoodwinked by Hitler, and forced to concede bit by bit, a real affront to British power and Britain's sense of its own martial prestige, having, as many British people felt they had been, being pushed around by Hitler or intimidated. The simplicity of conflict was better than this rather unsatisfactory state of affairs. Sumner Wells, of course, met Churchill, and Churchill and Anthony Eden both told him that there was no alternative than the total and utter defeat of Nazism and the destruction of the Third Reich. Obviously, Churchill knew full well that this couldn't be achieved without the United States of America. Churchill knew that what he had to say would be conveyed back to Roosevelt, and he knew that sending Roosevelt a message that there were at least some figures in the British government that were determined to fight to the end no matter the cost was going to be of immense political value. America needed to be certain of the British, particularly Roosevelt, before even considering any kind of involvement or aid. So when Wells goes home, he says that the picture is this, that there's no chance of negotiating with Hitler or Mussolini. But also, the idea that at least the British are just going to fold is unlikely, that the British, no matter what, will fight. So, very briefly after Wells' return to America, the war in the West begins. The Nazis occupy Denmark, and then the attack on Norway begins. And the attack on Norway and Britain and France's rather inept response to it are the kind of the moments on which Churchill's story hinges, because this is the cause of the downfall of Chamberlain. The British and French on one side, aided by the Poles who had escaped from Poland, and the Germans on the other, were in a race to occupy Norway. Norway was a source of iron and coal and other precious metals and raw materials, and also it was a route by which raw materials were exported from Sweden and down through Norway to the North German ports. So it was an enormously important country. it didn't really fit into any of Hitler's kind of Lebensraum goals. It was full of the kinds of Aryans that Hitler was rather fond of. But all the same, Hitler was mainly exercised by the fear that it might fall into British and French hands. That would mean that large parts of the Northern Atlantic would be off limits to the German Navy. The British learn a salutary lesson and are taught it by the Germans in organisation. At sea, the British inflict huge losses on the German Navy. The German Navy is quite badly mauled by the Royal Navy. But on land, the inability to coordinate infantry, artillery, air power and armour is little short of embarrassing. The British become stranded at northern ports along the Norwegian coast, and British soldiers show quite a shocking ill discipline as they indeed wind up kind of ransacking, in some cases, Norwegian homes. It's not the army that emerges later on. The ineptitude, the failure and the poor planning of the operation lead to the Norway debates, where Chamberlain is absolutely torn to shreds by Parliament. The government's own backbenchers, conservative backbenchers, implore, as one backbencher does, for Chamberlain, "In the name of God, man, go." And they cite Oliver Cromwell, who, when he was dismissing the Long Parliament, said, "You have sat too long here for any good you have been doing. Depart, I say, and let us have done with you." When you even have retired admirals turning up to take their seat in Parliament to condemn the Prime Minister, it's all over. Now, Chamberlain does win the vote of no confidence against him, but he wins by such a slender margin that he knows it's not really a victory at all, and he goes to King George VI to tell him that his position is untenable. There are two candidates who could possibly lead the country. One is Lord Halifax, Conservative peer, and the other is Churchill. The Labour Party say that they will not join any government, any kind of government of national crisis, with Chamberlain, and the position of Lord Halifax is also as a wartime leader untenable, because he would have to run the war from the House of Lords and not from the House of Commons. So Churchill is the only realistic choice, and on May the 10th, he manages to take office and steps into 10 Downing Street as Prime Minister and also the Minister for Defence. So Churchill had an immense amount of power to manage the war in the way that he saw fit. And on that same day, on the 10th of May, the German Blitzkrieg began in the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg, and would later push directly into France. The German paratroops, for example, landed in the Netherlands. They seized the fort of Eben-Emael in Belgium, and then a huge column of 1,800 tanks poured into northern France around the Maginot Line. And as we know, I think I've done a podcast on Dunkirk before, cut upwards towards the coast in the Sickleschnitt move, which had originally been, despite how many times Hitler claimed credit for this one, had been drawn up by one of his most talented generals, von Manstein. The British and the French are lured into Belgium, where a smaller German force marched, and then they are cut off and forced back to a pocket at Dunkirk, where it was hoped by Hitler that they would be finished off. on May the 15th, Paul Reynaud, the French Prime Minister, said to Churchill, "You know, we've been defeated, and the defeat, and in that month, the Operation Dynamo at Dunkirk happens, and 338,000 troops are rescued from the beaches. And this is what gives Britain its ability to fight on. The entire equipment of the British Expeditionary Force." Which when the Germans see it, they can't believe how well equipped and how well looked after the British soldiers are. That has to be left behind. And this meant was, you know, 7,000 included 90,000 rifles, 7,000 tons of ammunition and 120,000 vehicles. And it would be this disaster that would have a profound effect on the relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt. Now you had the Prime Minister of a belligerent power, backed by an Allied President who was keen to do what he could, and it was a belligerent power that was had a fighting force bereft of equipment, and it just so happened that the United States was the world's greatest manufacturing force. Churchill understood full well that war production wins wars just as much as fighting men and boots on the ground does. And the retreat at Dunkirk had taken away most of Britain's means of fighting. He said, "Many months must elapse before this loss could be repaired." And he was mindful of the fact that whilst there was an effective fighting force in the guise of the RAF and in the Royal Navy, if the Germans were successful in a land invasion, the British would be virtually powerless to stop them, having lost most of their armour and artillery. As we'll explore in later podcasts, because I intend to continue on this theme, loss of France is an enormous body blow, not just to Great Britain, but to America as well. The British thought that a war would be fought in France for some time, a matter of years, that there would perhaps be something of a stalemate, and that would give the British time to fully rearm. The American world view in the summer of 1940 was that Britain may well be next, and that would leave America worryingly exposed with only an Atlantic Ocean between the United States and a very hostile fascist Europe. And now we have to kind of return really to Joseph Kennedy. Joseph Kennedy believed that the catastrophe of Dunkirk would be followed by an offer that Britain would have to take. And here is where Kennedy's predictions are wrong, in that in spite of what appeared to be a hopeless situation, Churchill rallied the cabinet. Firstly, he makes his famous speech, Fight them on the beaches speech in Parliament, and then he engages the cabinet days later, saying essentially that any kind of peace deal would mean slavery for the British Isles, and if not actual physical slavery, then a kind of moral slavery. But much of this was theatre, and the audience was, of course, the White House. And being able to show America that no matter what, the British resolve was firm was an essential part of Churchill's political role. His ability to be forceful, theatrical, a great orator, had implications in the British Isles in terms of building morale amongst the British people, though if you look at the histories of that, it's questionable how far people really bought into Churchill. But it also has huge implications for America and the presenting the sympathetic position of an embattled Britain willing to fight to the end. Did an enormous amount to bring American public on side for aid for Britain, but it also encouraged Roosevelt to think that if fighting was necessary, if American troops in the war were necessary, then there would be a reliable partner in the guise of Great Britain, led by Winston Churchill. Anyway, I hope you found this useful and helpful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.